Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, this is an episode of episodes. This is the John Hamm episode. This is the exceptionally cast indie film episode. This is the animal episode, and we each saw an animal film that the other one didn't see. You saw a gorilla movie.
That's right.
And I saw an aardvark movie. It's also a Sundance episode. Bunch of Sundance movies on here from previous years. This is the episode of episodes.
This is the episode that has a bunch of things that, the masses won't necessarily have heard about yet.
Not even masses. This is like, even people who say, I'm really into movies and I know a lot about movies are going to be like, what?
And I've never heard of any of these except.
You've heard of the movie batting leadoff because Hannah got to go out this week. She got to go out this week and see a movie in the movie theater. Unlike me, she saw Dwayne The Rock Johnson in Rampage. We saw that preview together a couple times, and we tore it apart, Hannah.
We were like, oh, we can't go see
it
that one.
So we were not going to go to this.
I know, but
and
then
you
I,
went.
I know, because I saw The Rock promoting it somewhere, and I'm like, oh, he's just too much fun. And so I'm like, how bad can it really be? And honestly, he makes what would otherwise be a really bad disaster movie somehow work. He just does. I don't know what it is, but this is, it looks exactly like San Andreas. It has the same director.
Kind of a bad action movie with The Rock.
It is, but in this case he plays a primatologist, because really, don't you just think primatologist when you look at The Rock?
It reminds me of when Denise Richards played a nuclear scientist.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, here he is playing this primatologist who has this very unique bond and friendship with this gorilla named George.
Oh, George.
A silverback gorilla.
Curious George.
That our hero, The Rock, had actually saved as a young ape.
Well, that's nice of The Rock.
But what happens, though, is that this mild-mannered gorilla somehow gets exposed to this genetic experiment gone awry that causes good old George to increase exponentially in size overnight and go into a rampage.
That is very close to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but they protected us from evil villains. Is George protecting us from evil villains?
No, George becomes a bad gorilla.
Bad gorilla. It's a bad gorilla.
But you know, there's always that, there's the George, the gentle giant is in there somewhere.
You just gotta find him.
And so, but the problem is that George isn't the only beast that gets exposed and goes on a rampage. There's two other things, and it's sort of like this, a wolf and a Loch Ness monster kind of creature. And so somehow these three huge rampaging creatures all end up converging on downtown Chicago and throwing buildings and cars and things around like Tonka toys. And, of course, our hero, The Rock, who plays this guy named Davis Okoye. Somehow everybody understands how to say his name right off the bat in this movie.
Professor Okoye.
Exactly. It's like, how did they know this? But he then, with the help of this other scientist woman, ends up going in search of an antidote because he wants to save George and, of course, millions of other people in the process.
There's a little shade I'm picking up of Godzilla.
Uh-huh.
Remember that 2014?
Big shades of Godzilla.
When they tear apart San Francisco.
Yes, this is Godzilla, Loch Ness Monster, all of your favorite sort of beast disaster. King Kong, a lot of King Kong in here. And so if you took King Kong, Godzilla, Loch Ness Monster, you put them all on steroids and sent them into downtown Chicago, and you had The Rock trying to save the day, there you have Rampage. And, I mean, he's so self-deprecating. He's fun to watch. He's got those big bulging muscles that come in very handy and are exposed at every possible opportunity throughout this film. And he just makes it watchable and fun, but it is very much like any of his usual disaster movies. It really has that same San Andreas vibe. It's like he's in a helicopter. Things are crashing all around him, and he somehow has to single-handedly save gazillions of people. And that's what he did in San Andreas, and that's what he does in this film. And so it is for fans of The Rock. If you are in the mood for a good disaster flick, that's what this is. And you can be assured that in the end, things will kind of turn out okay for George.
Well, poor Chicago, because I remember a couple Transformers films also tore that city apart.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it is as light and lovable and rockable as...
It's not light.
But it doesn't... It just sounds terrible.
Well, it's all about this it's got these cartoonish villains that have weaponized DNA. And that's, where these animals suddenly, get infected with this weaponized DNA. And so for the corporate greed, the evil villains who are happy to see that this is actually all working the way they intended, but it's gotten a little out of hand, that part of it is in the mix too. So you have your bad guys and your good guys and your rampaging animals and a huge body count. There's a very big body count, but I think it's like a PG-13, so it never gets too bloody, or a lot of the stuff happens kind of a little bit off camera.
Meh.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be terrible that you missed it, Charlie, but I'm glad I saw it because, with the rest of the movies coming up, we had to see at least one that the audience might have heard of.
Well, speaking of cities that just get torn apart, San Francisco, Chicago, let's talk about a movie called Beirut. Talk about a city that gets torn apart. Mm-hmm. But this is period Beirut, and it's our first of multiple John Hamm films.
I only saw one John Hamm film this week, and it was Beirut.
So. John Hamm plays a diplomat. He's a Department of State diplomat hanging out in Beirut. He's the life of the party. He's hosting the Beirut elite, and it's a period piece. So he's a period diplomat, and it starts out in like 72. So he's got like the mutton chops and the hair and the leisure suit. And that's just kind of the preamble to what the Beirut really is, 1982. they do more period details, but they jump ahead a decade after something happens in the beginning, and they play around in the 80s, and they get to play around with the hair, they play around with the clothing, they play around with the vibe.
The atmosphere, absolutely.
And they do very well. Not only do they do 1982 in the United States, the terrible cars, he drives a Pinto, they do 1982 Beirut. Now, they did not shoot in Beirut.
I think it was Morocco or something.
They shot in Tangier, Morocco, which they say, matter-of-factly, resembles 19-whatever war-ravaged Beirut. That's like, oh, way to go, Tangier.
Yeah, right.
So it's not an action movie.
No.
It's borderline thriller, maybe kind of a suspense, because it takes place in a war-torn country, but it's also a character study. Yes, he's trying to save a hostage. He's trying to save his friend who got kidnapped, but it's a redemption film. He's seeking redemption from a tragic past. John Hamm is a sad man. He's a very, very sad man. And along with the help of a good-looking Rosamund Pike, maybe he'll just pull through, Hannah.
Yeah, no, Rosamund Pike does not have much to do in this movie until maybe the last 15 minutes. So, I would have liked to have seen a little more out of her earlier on in the film. But John Hamm, this is a very good role for him, but this is a not-so-thrilling spy thriller. It just is. It's middle of the road, but the fact that, John Hamm is in it makes it... It's a good role. He really embraces it. But it's really kind of like a Jason Bourne light, and it's, I believe, the same writer.
Well, the reason it feels Jason Bourne light, and it's very light because John Hamm's not Jason Bourne. He doesn't punch anybody. It's written by Tony Gilroy. He wrote the first Bourne trilogy. Then he wrote and directed that Bourne knockoff with Jeremy Renner, the Bourne Legacy. And he's also been nominated for two Oscars. He wrote and directed Michael Clayton with George Clooney, 2008. Talk about a thriller with no punches thrown.
Right, but and that so there's elements, but I think he actually wrote Beirut years ago. Like apparently he wrote it a long time ago before all the Bourne movies. So this one had sort of been sitting around a while. It just doesn't have, you know, there. It's that level of action and drama and intensity that that you're sort of used to from a spy thriller. So that's what makes it just. It's just missing something. It doesn't quite rise to that next level of being like a really good, intriguing spy drama. It's just one of those ones where it is interesting to sort of go back to 1982 and to remember this war. You know, just basically, it also reminds you that nothing's really changed. That the efforts at peace in the Middle East have just kind of gone in circles, and you see the root of that in this film. But it's. It really is just standard stuff, and it doesn't go anywhere special.
I'm 100% on board with you. Beirut did not thrill me. It didn't bore me.
Right.
I was happy I saw it. I wasn't bored, but it's missing more than one piece. It's missing two or three pieces to really tie it together. Rosamund Pike has nothing to do. Nothing.
Exactly.
She's what a waste. And it also reminded me of something... that we saw a couple months ago that was nominated for an Oscar, The Insult. It's like it's kind of the preamble to The Insult. They're different enough where it's not a back-to-back watch. They don't fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, but they're close enough to be like, oh, look, two Beirut movies in a year.
Yeah, and just how different parties have different agendas and how they come into play and how the same situation can be viewed so differently by several different people. And with Beirut, I mean, you've got Israel and the PLO and the terrorists in Lebanon. And so it's, you're familiar with all these players. So even though it's a period drama reflecting 1982, I think the reason that it might get at least a little traction now is just that it feels very timely, even though it's a 1982 drama.
And it was directed by Brad Anderson, and he's done some really middle-of-the-road stuff recently, like 2013's The Call with Halle Berry. But he did something about 14 years ago that I loved. I think it's still my favorite Christian Bale movie to date, The Machinist. Christian Bale lost like 150 pounds and was just this stick figure of a being, and The Machinist is just a fascinating like 4-star film that threw me for a loop, and it's weird to see that this is the same guy, Brad Anderson.
Yeah, so it's a spy drama that I would put sort of in your Netflix queue if it's a genre that you're interested in.
And I mean, you have to be pretty down in that queue.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of period pieces, you also saw some Mutton Chops with Shia LaBeouf. And Shia LaBeouf messing around as
John McEnroe.
What's up with John McEnroe?
Yeah, and honestly, this movie was not so much about McEnroe as it was about Bjorn Borg. And so it's called Borg versus McEnroe. And apparently it was also called, I think, just Borg in some places. And Borg / McEnroe on some posters. And it really, even though Shia LaBeouf is the name that most people in the States will recognize, this movie's really about Bjorn Borg and his 1980 match with John McEnroe at Wimbledon, which was a really big deal. It's considered like this classic epic final where it went five sets and tiebreakers galore and just intense, long match. And Borg was going for his record-setting fifth straight Wimbledon victory, and then you had John McEnroe as this up-and-coming, temperamental American that was just really just kind of new to the scene and was going for his first Wimbledon victory. But this movie is like a Danish movie, so it's sort of like this foreign film, sports drama, psychological drama. It's actually more psychological drama than sports, and it was different. Just a very different kind of sports movie because it intercuts like 1980 as they're preparing for this epic match, and it flashes back to their childhoods, their youth, and various points in time where you kind of get a sense of what drives both of these men. And so for tennis aficionados and for tennis fans who have any memory of the 1980 match in that era And when McEnroe was just coming on the scene, and when Borg was actually just kind of wrapping up his run, they might get something out of this film. The last part with the match itself is the most interesting and the most driven and encouraging. It's just the part of the movie that you're actually like finally into this film. But that's really the last 20 minutes. The first two-thirds of this movie get kind of slow and draggy, and you're just kind of waiting for that match to come around. And then once the match is in play, then you're all in. And, of course, at the end, you see the real photos with the real players, and Borg and McEnroe actually ended up becoming very good friends. And I think you would like it. It's actually a very unique, different sports biopic.
If I'm a tennis fan and I saw Battle of the Sexes last year, which showed me Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs, or Steve Carell, if you will, and it was a good tennis film, but it didn't knock anybody's socks off. Everyone thought it was going to be this Oscar picture, and it wasn't. What am I thinking about this movie?
Yeah, this is more of an indie. So whereas Battle of the Sexes had these big stars in it and was, you know, supposed to be sort of a lot more comical, even though I didn't find it that funny. Borg versus McEnroe is a much smaller, quieter, indie vibe film. And so I'm not sure it's necessarily going to appeal to those who went to see Battle of the Sexes really for Emma Stone and Steve Carell. You know, and this is Shia LaBeouf, who I think is an acquired taste and has sort of put people off a little bit with his choices.
That's you know, like an artist in his work. Shia LaBeouf has put people off in his real life, but he's actually a phenomenal actor.
Yeah, and so that's why he does a very good job as John McEnroe, and you know, with because McEnroe is really, he was well known for pushing back against the establishment, and tennis is supposed to be a very, to some degree, a refined sport, and McEnroe was anything but. You know, he challenged the calls, and he, you know, the whole, are you serious? It's like you actually hear him saying that and remembering how that happened. But what was fascinating with this film is you see that McEnroe actually ended up sort of winning over the British with this match, because he really did keep himself in check for this particular match. And I don't think I really had thought about that much. The guy who played Bjorn Borg, I couldn't even begin to pronounce his name, but I'll tell you, he looks like a dead ringer for Bjorn Borg. Yeah, I should look and see if I even have it written here. Swedish actor Sverrir Gudnason.
All yours.
Sverrir Gudnason is the central figure in this movie. And he looks a lot like Bjorn Borg in his heyday. And so, yeah, tennis fans, Wimbledon fans, Borg and McEnroe, if the whole Jimmy Connors era, it was really funny to sort of see that there was at one point a press conference that these two are at, and you see other tennis players like Jimmy Connors at this table, but barely touched on. It wasn't there. This is not their movie. It is truly just focusing on the psychological aspects of this tennis rivalry between Borg and McEnroe.
I am not bummed that I miss Rampage, but I am kind of bummed I miss this one. This does sound like more in my wheelhouse.
It does.
A psychological sports drama. And McEnroe and Borg are before my time. I wasn't, you know, really alive or had conscious thought to pay attention to that. I came of age in the Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi era. But this does sound pretty good.
Yeah, these were the precursors to those guys. And I remember it because I had a great aunt who was very into tennis and took us to the U.S. Open matches in the 80s, in that era. And so even players like Vitas Gerulaitis is in this film quite a bit. And so when you know who some of these people are, and it just triggered sort of fond memories of that era for me.
All right. Somewhat of a psychological drama. Dark Drama is our next film. It's also an indie film. Where is Kira? It's a question mark film. It's an interrogative statement as a title. Where is Kira? And Kira is surprisingly Michelle Pfeiffer in a very un-Michelle Pfeiffer role. You don't see her too much anymore. But here she is, and she's looking, you know, it's going to make you feel old. Because Michelle Pfeiffer is looking older. She's been around a while.
Yeah, except when you see her sort of, when you see most of her in some of these scenes, and her, she still has like this rockin' bod.
She's still very tiny.
And so when you see that, you sort of, you're like, okay, now I remember. She's aging very well.
And it co-stars Kiefer Sutherland, another guy who's been around. Remember Lost Boys? I mean, this guy's been around a while.
So they've aging well.
They've both moved up a generation, if you will, but they're not making it. Life has hit them hard. They're struggling. And it's directed by a guy named Andrew Dozenmue. He's a Nigerian. He hit Sundance pretty hard a couple years ago with a film called Mother of George, and he's back. This was a Sundance 2017 feature, and it is very dark. It's about, you know, if you're walking around New York City, and when you walk around New York City, you see the homeless. And this makes Andrew Dozenmue, you wonder, why are they here? What happened? And this is kind of a story, maybe, of what happened to one of these people. It's, you know, people who live paycheck to paycheck. And what happens when you do that and you lose your job? Michelle Pfeiffer, as Kira, has lost everything. She lost her husband. She lost her job. She lost her mom. Yeah. And she is struggling.
Yeah, I mean, part of what they're trying to reinforce too with one of the themes of this film is, and I've been doing a lot of work with family caregiving, and so what this really was saying was that he or she had sort of taken on the primary caregiving role for her mother, and who was getting older and getting her disability and social security checks and all that, and basically that was the money that was supporting both of them. It was supporting the daughter and the mother. And so when the mother then dies, it's really about, you know, here's this woman who for the past year has been primarily operating as a caregiver and relying on that paycheck. And what happens when suddenly you don't have that paycheck because the mom's gone and you haven't found a job yet, and you're of that age where just people aren't hiring the older workers. And so that's, you know, those are themes that I think are, you know, very important to sort of reinforce. Although I was hoping this movie was going to go somewhere else, so I was not expecting it to be as bleak as it was. So it really is a very bleak film from beginning to end.
And I am happy that it stayed bleak and it stayed real, because you know what? Sometimes you just need movies about real life, and you don't need the weaponized DNA.
Bleak is bleak, and sometimes you need an escape, and
you get that in every other movie. You get that, but sometimes we're watching a woman here fall through the cracks, as people do. She's falling into isolation, even though New York City has millions and millions of people. A lot of people are loners; they live in isolation. And Michelle Pfeiffer, Kira, and Kiefer Sutherland are two loners in the same building, and they sort of just discover each other, and then they realize they need each other. They need each other's support. She kind of cynically needs his financial help every now and then. It's not a lot. It's not paying her rent. But, you know, she's not going to starve. And he needs her because he's got his own past. And he's, you know, he's just grinding every day in a cab. And they really fit well together.
Yeah, and she makes some really bad choices. And so she's struggling. And that's a part of it, too, is that, you know, a part of Kiefer Sutherland's character just does not want to be involved because he's trying to walk the straight and narrow. He's trying to get his life back together. And so when her life starts unraveling, you know, in some respects, he's like, I just don't need this. And yet there's some sort of codependency factor going on there. And that carries through to the end.
You mentioned the elderly, and that's a strong sub theme in Where Is Kira, is the invisibility of the elderly. When they walk down the street with their two canes and they're shuffling along, people avoid them. They try to really limit their contact with the elderly. If there's one in front of you trying to get on the bus, you're like, just get on the bus. And, you know, that's, I'm not going to tell you why we're watching an elderly woman walk through New York City, but there's a reason. And it's telling that that's kind of how the elderly, especially in large urban areas, are kind of treated and invisible in this country.
And there's some heavy scoring going on in this film,
too. It's harsh. It's a harsh score.
Oh, I didn't even realize. All of a sudden, it finally clicked as to why I suddenly kept hearing this, like, ridiculous grinding-sounding score. And then I realized that it was happening on cue with particular events. But it was annoying, and I guess that's sort of what they were going for. But it made it, for me, just a little more difficult to watch. Because you have Michelle Pfeiffer and Kiefer Sutherland, you're going to have two really good performances. And so as bleak as this film is, their performances help you get through it. Because I know you said you were surprised I got through it.
I didn't think you were going to make it.
And that's pretty much why I did, is because, one, I like those two particular actors. And two, I just thought it was going to end better.
All right, our final film we're going to talk about tonight is one I saw that you did not see, called Aardvark. So this wraps up our John Hamm portion of it, because we have another John Hamm film. It wraps up the animal portion of it. It's, you know, called Aardvark, and there actually kind of is an aardvark in it. And it wraps up the exceptionally casted indie film. John Hamm's actually the lower tier on this, because he's a bit player. We're talking about Jenny Slate and Zachary Quinto. Jenny Slate from Obvious Child in her one season on Saturday Night Live. And Zachary Quinto, Mr. Spock.
Mr. Spock.
Commander Spock. This premiered at 2017's Tribeca Film Festival. It's by first-time film director Brian Schoaf. Think therapist and patient. That's kind of what we're revolving around here. Jenny Slate as Emily is the therapist, and Zachary Quinto is a very complicated character. He is the patient, and he has a mental illness, a clear mental illness. He is schizophrenic. He sees people that are not there. He hears voices that are not there. And he has unresolved issues, especially with his family, with his brother, he hasn't seen in 15 years, his brother John Hamm. He's got an extremely unresolved issue. And he heard his brother's back in town. And his brother, you think this would be one of his schizophrenic fantasies, is actually a famous actor. He's a famous TV actor who's been on one of those legal dramas for 15 years, and he's just known all over the world. The problem is, Zachary Quinto sees him as a phantom. So he'll show up as a bag lady or a police officer, and these people don't exist, but he thinks it's his brother in character, because he knows his brother is the best actor in the world. And then, to make it even more complicated, his therapist, Emily, becomes infatuated and starts, you know, hanging out with John Hamm a little bit.
Of course.
And then, you know, it's a movie about the ending, the estrangement. It's about engagement or estrangement coming to an end. And Emily, as therapist, can bring them together, or she can keep them apart. She has kind of a choice to make. Wrap it all up, this is a weak movie. It's poorly written. I don't know why these upper-tier actors are messing around with this material. Yes, especially Zachary Quinto and Jenny Slate, their roles are defined as juicy. Jenny Slate is actually the best actor in this film. She's very good. But what are they doing in this kind of McMovie? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and so when you see John Hamm in that, the same week that you see John Hamm in Beirut, what was the difference in the performance?
It's weird because, so he's in these two indie films, which is fine. People go indie all the time, but it's rare you get them on the same week, and they're both, well, film festival films. They're different. Beirut, he was in every scene. He's the man. Here, he's like the character more talked about than seen. But he's the same. He's got the swagger. He's got the moves. He's confident in Aardvark. We've seen that plenty of times with John Hamm. It's almost like Don Draper.
That's right.
And in Beirut, he was actually more serious. More, you know, he had to play sad. He's not sad in Aardvark. He's the man. So, no, Aardvark is... it's an odd film. It's an odd film. I don't really care about movies about mental illness, because it's very complicated to do correctly. It's rare you see a movie about that succeed and really connect with audiences. And it's just not very well written.
I haven't heard anything about it. I've not seen any promotion, which is surprising because it's got Jenny Slate and Zachary Quinto and John Hamm, but it's one that just sort of seems to just kind of be on the periphery. So chances are then if you're a John Hamm fan, you should see Beirut instead of Aardvark.
Well, you have an opportunity here. Scenes between therapists and patients, think The Sopranos, are just ripe for being well written, and the back and forth dialogue and these intense conversations. No, none of that.
She looks so young.
She's also not a psychiatrist. She's just blah, 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 like social worker.
Oh.
And it's very strange.
So she's sort of in training. She doesn't have her advanced degrees yet.
She's not a doctor.
Okay.
No. All right, to wrap up this, remember, this episode of episodes.
That's right, because what did we miss this week, Charlie?
Well, we did miss quite a few. We missed Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. So Blumhouse, we know, being that horror thing. But Blumhouse was also Get Out. So every now and then, Blumhouse does hit.
Okay.
But usually, yeah, they're known for the horror. And I saw some pretty bad reviews of it.
Yeah, we missed Crystal.
That's just as small as Aardvark, but it is directed by William H. Macy.
Yeah, so that's another one you might want to catch up on. But in terms of the horror movies, I just haven't had the motivation to go catch those in the theater when we've had to kind of limit what we can see. But I'm still glad I saw Rampage, which will be the biggest movie of the week.
Well, by far, it will be the biggest movie of the week.
I love The Rock.
Who doesn't love The Rock?
Who doesn't love The Rock? I mean, seriously.
All right, quick wrap up. The first animal film of the week. By the way, it's a video game movie, and I remember playing Rampage on my little 386 computer.
Oh, see, I didn't even know that.
All right, Rampage.
Rampage, absurd, ridiculous monster movie with The Rock. And so if that appeals to you in any way, go see it. And if you go, nope, nothing about that appeals to me, then just skip it.
Beirut is a subpar spy thriller that could.
Yeah, I agree.
The tennis movie.
Tennis movie, Borg versus McEnroe. It's a psychological movie more than a sports movie, but an interesting perspective on what drives two tennis stars from a classic match from 1980. If you happen to spot it, it's another one that I think you're fine just putting into that old Netflix queue. I don't think you need to see it in the theater.
Where is Kira is dark, rough, and bleak, therefore it is real, and therefore it's my favorite film of the week.
And because it's bleak, it's not my favorite film of the week. And I was like, oh, it's another one of those bleak Charlie movies. And so I'm glad you enjoyed it, but it was a little too bleak for me. I just don't want to really be depressed every week with some of these movies, and that was a depressing one.
Aardvark is an odd title, and it's just an odd little film all the way around. You are missing nothing unless you are a completist. If you have to see all John Hamm movies or all Zachary Quinto movies, then yeah, you're obligated to see it. But other than that, no, just stay away from this thing.
Yeah, it's not one that I feel like I have to go and catch up on.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you for listening.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.